Sometimes it is noble to keep fighting, even though you are taking a lot of punishment. I remember that back in my high school days, every underdog team that had a big game coming up would go to see the film Rocky the night before. The idea was that they would be so fired up by Rocky's never-say-die spirit that they would play above their talent and beat a superior team. I'm not sure, however, that as Rocky kept going all the way through Rocky 14, that he continued to be a good role model. Poor Adrian. By the time her husband was done fighting every opponent that wanted a piece of him, she was left married to a clump of broccoli. There comes a time when the unwillingness to call it quits is clearly not heroic, but rather stupid and self-destructive. And Job is well beyond that point now. He has taken numerous body blows since this confrontation with the Lord began. He is reeling around the ring. It's time to start hearing, "No mas, no mas." Time to throw in the towel. But Job is still up for more pain in his pursuit of vindication. You might say, "Well, Steve, he is putting his hand over his mouth here in verse 4. He admits that he has said quite enough. And yes, that is certainly an improvement. But if this had meant that he was in the right spiritual place, God would not have continued the barrage. Job might not bring additional charges here, but he does not repent until after chapter 41. He's not ready for that yet. So the discipline continues. The previous questions had been tough enough. Job did not know how the creation was constructed, how the various elements worked together, what the little animals were doing in their various hiding places. But as clearly as these matters demonstrated Job's ignorance, these previous matters, they're still kind of out there, aren't they? You know, the heavens and, you know, what's going on out there in the countryside and so forth. At most, Job was learning, you know, he should not be trying to instruct the Lord on how he sovereignly dispenses with what he has made. But now the Lord bores in on Job's biggest sin. Hey, we're working into the heart of the matter. Job had accused God of doing wrong to him. So God now asks questions about their own relationship. Questions that really more focus on who is God? What kind of person is he? He asks questions about how Job was treating him. Well, these kinds of questions are the most convicting of all. It's one thing to admit that, okay, I don't know exactly where heaven and hell are. I don't know what the ostrich is all about. Okay, you know, I admit it. It's another to ponder your own offensive actions toward God. And perhaps this line of questioning from God will serve to put us in the right spirit as we come to the Lord's table. We will see that God never does address Job's big concern. You know, what was animating Job through all of those chapters, what he was determined to receive. He had that desire to have God declare him innocent of any sin in regard to the suffering that came upon him, in regard to his trials. God never speaks to that. Rather, he simply keeps asking questions that reveal more and more clearly how prideful Job had been in making any charges against his Creator. We have two main questions from the Lord tonight. We have so many questions that we've been dealing with, and I've been trying to kind of summarize them down into a few, and tonight we have two. And the first one comes in verses 1 through 8 of chapter 40, and this question is, will you condemn me? Will you condemn me? Verses 1 through 8. Then the Lord said to Job, will the fault finder contend with the Almighty? Let him who reproves God answer it. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I have spoken, and I will not answer. Okay, even twice, and I will add nothing more. And it was more than twice. Anyway, we understand what he's getting at. Then the Lord answered Job out of the storm and said, now gird up your loins like a man. I will ask you, and you instruct me. Will you really annul my judgment? Will you condemn me that you may be justified? So what is Job's title now in God's sight? What title does he give him? The fault finder. Job the fault finder. This is the only time this noun appears in the Old Testament. But it comes from the same word family as the verb reprove in the second part of the verse there. Job had taken upon himself the role of official reprover. That's kind of how God is setting him up. Okay, you're the official reprover. And his fault finding had extended even to God. Different verbs are used throughout this passage that I've read to describe that general stance that he had toward God right now. This fault-finding stance. He contends or strives with God in verse 2. He instructs in verse 7. He annuls in verse 8. And that's the idea of breaking something, making it ineffectual. And then the word that really gets your attention in verse 8, right? Job condemns God. Yeah, and that's right what it seems to mean. It means to declare another person as guilty of wrong. Job condemns God. Well, I mean, you kind of put all these things together, and they seem to be in the top 10 of what you don't want to do toward God. But the Lord clarifies that this is what Job had been doing. Do Job's previous words confirm this? You know, we've done this as we've gone along. When the friends were saying, you know, you're doing this or you're this way or whatever, we looked and saw whether that was true or not. And we do the same thing with what God says. Is he being just in declaring that this is where Job had been in his stance toward God? We can begin back in Job 9. Don't know how many months that might go back in this study. But Job 9, verses 22 through 24, this is what Job had to say about the way God was conducting his business. It's all one. Therefore, I say, he destroys the guiltless and the wicked. He destroys the guiltless, the innocent, in other words, and the wicked. If the scourge kills suddenly, he mocks the despair of the innocent. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it's not he, then who is it? Some definite fault finding, I think, there. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 3 is interesting because there Job accuses God of what God is now accusing Job. 10, 1 through 3. I loathe my own life. I will give full vent to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend with me. Is it right for you indeed to oppress, to reject the labor of your hands, and to look favorably on the schemes of the wicked? I was saying, you're condemning me, God, and contending with me for no good reason. God is now turning that around and saying, are you condemning me? Are you contending with me? And the trend continued from there to chapter 10, verse 7. According to your knowledge, I am indeed not guilty, yet there is no deliverance from your hand. 13:3. But I would speak to the Almighty, and I desire to argue with God. 15b, I will hope in him. Nevertheless, I will argue my ways before him. Chapter 23, verse 4. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. He's full of arguments to present to God. Just let him at it. Just give him an opportunity and he will just pour them out, and boy, will God have a hard time answering for what he's done. And we've seen more than this over the past months. I just picked out some of these, and we're going to have a couple more verses on the condemnation part in a bit, but you know, we're not going to belabor that point. What we can say is that Job has not been showing the spirit of be merciful to me, a sinner. That's not the tone that we've been getting out of Job. Job rather had the spirit of Adam right from the very start. Hey, don't look at me, Lord, about this forbidden fruit thing. You gave me the woman. I mean, what is that? This is finding fault with God. This is something you did that messed things up here, not what I did. I mean, this is your problem, God. Job had the spirit of Jonah. Jonah had quite the attitude. Lord, did I not know that you were going to be this way toward Nineveh? That's why I was running from you. I knew that you were going to do the wrong thing here. You shouldn't be showing mercy to these people. If you show mercy to anyone, let's get it going back in Israel here. But here, this is ridiculous. This book has been a running accusation against God that he's unjust. And he's culpable for this misery that Job is experiencing. And the Lord now wants an explanation for this. You're doing this, Job. What are you really trying to do? What are you thinking you're going to accomplish? Are you really going to pursue this? Before we look at Job's response to the Lord, it's perhaps profitable, though uncomfortable, certainly for me, to consider whether We have the title of fault finder, you know, in God's sight, along with Job. Okay, fault finder. Probably no one here would need to confess to telling God he's in the wrong in a matter that's quite as blatant as what we've read from Job. Probably we don't need to, you know, confess that we've actually, you know, condemned God for something. But there are ways of getting across that general idea that, you know, that are a little more subtle, indicating to him that he's really not managing affairs all that well. Do you think that it is your role to show others their faults? You know, often a negative approach to others is evidence of that negative approach to God. You've really got a problem with God, and one of the ways that that comes out is you've got to find something negative about everyone around you. There's so much in the New Testament about avoiding that kind of a judgmental, contentious kind of a spirit. And we know, and we've talked about it, that very often just telling someone the truth is seen as judgmental. And we're not talking about that tonight. But is there a fault-finding spirit? We had James 5:9 before us not long ago. And it said, "Do not complain, brethren, against one another, so that you yourselves may not be judged. Behold, the judge is standing right at the door." There's that thought that we need to serve as judge for those around us. And 1 Peter 4:8-9. This struck me as the spirit with which we should be participating in the Lord's Supper. "Above all, keep fervent in your love for one another, because love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaint." James talking about stop complaining and judging. He's saying, you know, do what you do, serve one another without complaint, and allow the love of Christ within you to cover a multitude of things that be done against you. We know that there are some things that ought not to be overlooked, even as we forgive. But there is a love that just covers the difficulties, the irritations, even the sins, yes, of others. So Job is given an opportunity to respond to God's question. So, you know, are you the reprover? Okay, is that what's going to go on here? And we see that he's not up to the task. He does walk this back pretty significantly here. We saw before, he was not able to say anything intelligent about God's creation. Now, I don't know, we might say that he's going to take the fifth in regard to his fault finding, because it might tend to incriminate him. So he's just going to put his hand over his mouth. He's going to say, okay, I better not say anything more. Remember all of Job's bold words about how his mouth was going to be full of arguments if given the opportunity? God saying, okay, here it is. Give me all those wonderful arguments you've got prepared for me. Job said he'd carry an indictment from God as a banner of honor. But when given the floor here, Job blinks. He does not proceed with all of those grand plans. So is Job's answer in verses 4 and 5 a good one? Was that a good answer to give to when God gave him this opportunity? Well, okay, it's certainly good to quit while you're behind. I suppose we give him that. He didn't dig a deeper hole. Shows a certain level of wisdom to say, you know what? I'm just going to keep quiet at this point. But when faced with the majesty of God, his voice thundering out of the whirlwind, I don't know that it's a greatly admirable move to simply say, well, I think I better rest my case at this point. I don't know that, you know, that's really worth a lot. As Job himself replies, what is there to say to the Almighty God? The important issue is, does Job think he has been wrong in the words and the tone of his many speeches? What is he really thinking about what he's done toward God? What do his words reflect? Is it the frustration, maybe, of, well, I can't fight God. You know, he's got all the tough questions. He's got the power. This isn't really a fair situation, but, you know, I'm still right. Even though I'm not looking very good in this proceeding, you know, I still know deep down I'm right, even though I've really got to be quiet now. Well, the fact that God picks right up where he left off tells us a lot, I think, about where Job still is. God is still angry. God is still speaking out of the storm. So Job is not where he needs to be. He still has the thought that God, you know, acted as his enemy, that he still ought to be receiving vindication. So God seems to relaunch his discipline. Did you notice that when I read those words of 7? Did that ring any kind of a bell for you? It's exactly like 38:2 when God first started talking to Job. It's cranking it back up again. Okay, you're not where you need to be. How often does that happen with us? Okay, gird up your loins like a man. Get yourself ready. There's even more probing questions coming your way. This, if you think that was going to make things easier for you, wrong. Hey, if you're here to school me, so do it. But the idea that like a man, that becomes more and more telling. God did not need such preparation. He's ever ready with infinite knowledge and wisdom. So we finish this point with a closer look at verse 8. God had made the judgment about what was right to bring to Job. Was Job really going to seek to annul that? He had neither the wisdom to see why God might have done this or the ability to keep God from performing his will. So that was dead before it started. But again, it's that last question that jumps out. Job had declared God guilty of wrong conduct. Here's just a couple more verses on this so that we can be reminded of what Job had said and what God is referring to. Job 19:6, Know then that God has wronged me and has closed his net around me. Okay, well, that's pretty plain. God has wronged me. 27:2. As God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty who has embittered my soul. He's taken away my right. Well, that's wrong. We don't need to say the words, God, I condemn you, to, in effect, have done that. Those words are saying that. And God makes that clear. All we need to do is just indicate God has not done right by us. And that puts him in the wrong, you know, however we put it. That's what we're doing. Why would we do such a thing? Why would we come to the point where we would say, you know, God, you're wrong on this? God nails it in the last words here of this point. The last words of 8, doesn't he? We condemn God so that our own words and actions will be justified. We want our own perspective to be acknowledged as the right one. If we have to say that God is wrong to do that, to justify what we've done, we'll do it. And that might take place through a little reinterpretation of his word. It might be emphasizing one truth to the exclusion of another. Maybe we'll simply operate in man's wisdom. But we want to be right, even if it puts God in the wrong. Like Job in 13:18, we've prepared our case. We know that we're going to be vindicated because this is the way we see things. Got to be right. The irony here is that the Lord had planned to vindicate Job all along. Job could have received that without all this discipline that he's now receiving if he had been patient and trusted in the Lord to work out his good plan. He would have seen himself vindicated. But he didn't. He had to try and force this issue. I must say that these words have a certain ring to them in the light of the table before us. Will you condemn me that you may be justified? I don't know. That kind of hit me. Was God condemned that we might be justified? Yeah, he was. God must show his righteous anger toward Job here, and he's getting into that. But I don't think we can miss the ultimate mercy that we find in there. And the ultimate mercy that he is showing toward Job. Christ took on the faults of the fault finders. But only those who have repented of their opposition to God are welcome here at this table. We have to be where Job had not got to yet to rightly participate here. We come now to the question of our second main point, which is, do you have my power? Verse 9 speaks of the arm and the voice of God. These communicate his might and his authority. And I've divided this section as God does, looking first at God's power regarding men and then regarding this animal named Behemoth. I've often said Behemoth. Dictionary says Behemoth. So take your pick. I might, you know, say both of them as we go along, but whatever the case. We have still most of our verses to cover. You might be getting a little nervous, but I think that we can run through these rather quickly. Let's read 9 through 14. Or do you have an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like His? Adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, and clothe yourself with honor and majesty. Pour out the overflowings of your anger, and look on everyone who is proud and make him low. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them in the dust together, bind them in the hidden place. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. Do you see what God is essentially asking Job here? And this is something that we do at times with others, though undoubtedly often in a fleshly way. But God is saying, you know, you seem to have a lot of good ideas about how I should be acting as the God of the universe. You seem to know better than I do, you know, how things should be going down with you. Well, how about taking over as supreme ruler? Why don't we just do that? You go ahead and you seem to be able to take my place. You seem to want to. Why don't we just go ahead and give you that position and see how it works out? We knew the old switcheroo, the old prince and the pauper on the biggest stage. You can display the power that I've been shown. You can create fear in man with your voice in the storm. I'll let you have a crack at that. Can you imagine Job's thunder? Boom! All creation is saying, is that all you got? God was a lot more fearsome than that. Make yourself glorious, Job. You're seeing what I'm displaying here. How are you going to do? You know, make it clear from just your radiant and majestic appearance that you're the one that calls the shots. Awe people with your presence. But I have to tell you, you're not off to a great start in that stinking pile that you're in. It's not looking good for you there. I'm not sensing you're commanding a lot of respect right now. Are you going to go around humbling the proud? You want to take over that role? That was a big point about Elihu's speech in regard to God's ability. He can humble the proud. More points for him. So Job, you know, there's this guy in a neighboring kingdom here. He's really gotten out of hand. He's abusing his authority. Why don't you just go and take care of him? When you've accomplished that, you know, you can just start on every arrogant person on the face of the earth and, you know, work things out the way that's right. You just really seem to have this real heart for justice. You think I'm not really getting it done. Go for it. Let's see you ensure justice then everywhere, if you know how to do this. And then there's taking everyone to the grave and beyond. Can you determine the time and place for every soul, Job? You didn't seem to know all that much about Sheol when it came down to it, when I was questioning you about it. It didn't seem like you really understood how Sheol works. How are you going to get everyone situated there? So Job receives a real beat down here. When Job can do these things, then God would agree that Job could stand before him as an equal. But Job could not save himself, let alone anyone else. Again, I think this is so helpful in coming to the supper rightly. Your right hand cannot save you. when we question God's words and actions, that's really what we're doing. Saying, you know, we have this power. We're trying to take God's place. That's certainly Satan's determination. That's what he's trying to do. Let's confess. Hey, there's nothing about us that's going to accomplish anything that God can accomplish. We can't save anything. Only the Lord, graciously acting on our behalf, can redeem us from our Job-like sins, from our rebellions against him. And now, ladies and gentlemen, behold Behemoth. I wondered whether we should look at him in this message. You could have put him together with Leviathan, but it ended up that I have quite a bit on Leviathan, so that ended up being a bigger project. But it is fascinating that God so closely connects his creation of this beast with the demonstration of his own power. It's representative to us. It teaches us. Quick look at verses 15 through 24. Behold now Behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold now his strength in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He bends his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the ways of God. Let his maker bring near his sword. Surely the mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. Under the lotus plants he lies down, in the covert of the reeds and the marsh. The lotus plants cover him with shade. The willows of the brook surround him. If a river rages, he's not alarmed. He's confident, though the Jordan rushes to his mouth. Can anyone capture him when he's on watch? With barbs, can anyone pierce his nose? So, what is or what was Behemoth? The word is related to the one meaning beast in Hebrew, especially cattle. So this was a large beast, and that's obvious from the description. It's a beast that would probably be closer to a cow in form than any other animal. So we come to a best guess that this is something like a hippo. I used to think that this was unlikely because of the description of the tail as a cedar. I never really fit that in with a hippopotamus. They have rather unimpressive tails, all things considered. But then I read that the meaning could be that he has a stiffened tail when he's on the alert. It would be stiff like a cedar. And who knows if this beast could have had a larger tail than what we know today. It might be a species that's not around anymore. But I think that the rest of the description fits a gigantic hippo type creature very well. And that's been the most common understanding. And I don't see any particular reason to range far from it. There's no reason to think that this was not a familiar sight in the area thousands of years ago. This would be a creature that was unassailable, that was, you know, completely confident and secure in its element. In verse 15, the Lord says that he made Behemoth with Job. At least one commentator thought that God was being sarcastic here, as if Job had helped God with creation. Okay. I didn't see that. I took this as meaning they were created at the same general time. I made you, Job, and I made this Behemoth as well. Job is being reminded that he was created to reflect God, which he wasn't doing all that well at right now, and that other creatures were meant to communicate truths about God as well. And that this creature certainly did. Verse 19, was very interesting to me, kind of puzzled around about this. Behemoth is the first of the ways of God. And what might that mean? Well, it can't mean that he's the most important of God's creatures, because man clearly has that status. But in context, the idea seems to be that in terms of displaying raw power, this animal gets it done better than any creature that God made. The first in just that powerful idea, man is weak in comparison to this animal and what it can do. And that second line about the maker bringing his sword, that's kind of obscure. My trusty Hebrew scholars assert that the meaning of bring is more to give, and that the sword is a cultural reference to the teeth of this animal. In other words, the Lord gave Behemoth its impressive choppers. With all of these prodigious defenses, no one is going to capture Behemoth. It would be foolish in the extreme to attempt it. So again, we come up to what's the point of God saying, hey, observe this massive animal and its characteristics. Again, I think what's arresting here is that God made Behemoth a representative of something that we need to see about God. We're supposed to gaze upon the strength of this animal and draw conclusions from that. This creature could not be challenged by man. Interesting. Could not be challenged by man. So how could Job think that he could challenge the creator of Behemoth? Would he not be infinitely more powerful? We would back off from attacking any kind of dangerous creature. Oh, I don't want to mess with that. I'm not going to get within range of that. Would we then think that we can instruct, even condemn, the one who made those creatures and us? So let's wrap this up. Job did see God as his redeemer. We've already seen that. Been a while. But he said, my redeemer lives. We should not lose sight of his consistent, true faith in God as his redeemer. God was not treating Job as a pagan with these questions. You know, this is a humbling of pride of a believer that was tempted and fell. Job was harboring a fair measure of pride, and God had to keep questioning him to reveal to him the rashness of his challenge to God's ways. So to conclude, what about us? Are we still fighting God in some area of our lives? Say, I'd never just, you know, walk up to a bear like we were talking about in Sunday school and, you know, try and be brothers with the animals. But do we still engage in arguments with the creator of these things that we would never mess with? Is there an implied rebuke of God's management of our circumstances that's evident in our words about him? Our words about others and circumstances and so forth that really come from him. This table is a place of celebration of God's grace toward us. And some would say, hey, no word about confession of sin should be connected to this feast. This is just a time to just know that we're forgiven. Just enjoy this standing that we have with the Lord. And we ought to do that. But I think we need to eat with perspective. We need to eat soberly. Let's remember that we should have been the ones condemned, not Jesus. But God's mighty arm saved us from ourselves. So let's ponder our answers to God's questions. Make sure that they're right ones, as well as coming with great thanksgiving.